prepared.
Well, let me ask you what happens in other countries. How is high-stakes testing treated, for example, in a country you and I talked about, Korea?
Well, they're a little more hardcore, at least they used to be. It's not that I've kept up with this in 2024, but I just know that, historically speaking, you know, they take testing pretty seriously, and it's more of a no-excuses kind of atmosphere, and they just work really hard to make sure that it gets done. Whether they need extra tutoring, extra studying, whatever extra they have to do to get it done. And so, on one hand, that can create a lot of anxiety, and I'm sure there are some people that, you know, might crack under the pressure. But for other people, it pushes them to greater heights. I would say for the most part, it does the latter. It pushes them to greater heights. But with that being said, you know, if you teach people how to deal with pressure and deal with nervousness and stuff like that, then you can actually have the best of both worlds. So actually learn how to deal with pressure and be able to get the desired result. And then this ability to get the desired result will help them in the future with other, you know, high pressure situations.
On that note, Stephen Lee, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you for having me, John.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report. KPFK now in our fund drive. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. As Israel's war on Gaza pushes on in its 10th month, fears of regional escalation are growing with Israel's attacks in Yemen, Iran, and Lebanon. On July 20th, Israel attacked Yemen, where 6 people were killed and 87 wounded, according to Houthi authorities. On Tuesday, July 30th, Israel attacked Lebanon, bombing Beirut, where 3 people, including 2 children, were killed and 74 wounded in the strike. And in the early hours of Wednesday, August 1st, Israel carried out an attack in Iran's capital, Tehran, assassinating Hamas's political chief, Ismail Haniyeh, shortly after attending the swearing-in ceremony of Iran's newly elected president. UN Secretary General has denounced Israel's strikes on Beirut and Tehran as a, quote, dangerous escalation. Since October 7th, Israel has conducted more than 17,000 attacks in 5 countries, including the occupied Palestinian territory, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran, according to the analyzed data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. With us today to talk about Israel's more than 17,000 attacks on 5 countries since October 7th, including the occupied Palestinian territory, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran, and Israel's dangerous escalation of violence in the region, is our guest Hassan El-Tayeb, who is an author, songwriter, and Friends Committee on National Legislation's Legislative Director for Middle East Policy and Advocacy Organizer. Hassan leads FCNL's work to end U.S. military involvement in the Saudi-led war on Yemen, advocate for Palestinian human rights, and advance diplomacy with Iran. Hassan El-Tayeb, welcome to Middle East in Focus. We got another. Hassan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry. We can hear you. Sorry. We had just okay. A little bit of issues there. But we're glad that we can hear you and we can dive right into this very, very important conversation. Let's first start with Yemen. For those who are listening who might not know, can you talk about Israel's recent attack on Yemen and the response of the United States to Israel's attack?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. This is a perilous time for the region. Since the Israel-Gaza war erupted after October 7, we've seen a pattern of regional violence that is really worsening by the day. The administration has launched direct attacks on Yemen over its escalations on Red Sea shipping. And Israel recently attacked Hodeida port. This is a critical hub for humanitarian and commercial trade. Many people call Hodeida port the lifeline for almost 20 million Yemenis. And again, I see this as a continuation of a policy of collective punishment of civilians that we've seen from Israel since the October 7 attacks. The administration has even said that any strikes on Houthi targets will not have any impact on deterring future Houthi attacks. And so even still, we're finding ourselves again in this ongoing spiraling regional conflict with significant risks of escalation. There are a lot of people that say that the U.S. really needs to pull back. We need to prioritize diplomacy. One, just because it's putting the whole region at risk, risking U.S. national security interests, worsening the crisis in Yemen. And ultimately, it's completely ineffective at resolving any of these deep-seated issues that we really need to address.
You know, as you pointed out, it's really worsening the already existing crisis in Yemen. And you know, something we always try to do on this show is to really highlight the situation in Yemen. In addition to Yemenis supporting Palestinians, what Yemenis are dealing with in terms of violence by the Saudi-led coalition in collaboration with the United States. So I want to get into that right now. A spokesperson for the Houthis posted on social media that the Israeli jets had attacked civilian facilities, oil tanks, and the electrical power station in the city of Hodeida in an effort to pressure the group to end its support for Gaza. Something the spokesperson said was, quote, a dream that will not come true, end quote. The spokesperson went on to say that the Israeli retaliation would only, quote, increase the determination of the Yemeni people who would continue to support the Palestinian people in what he termed as the most just cause on the face of the earth, end quote. So can you talk about the current situation in Yemen with respect to its own ongoing humanitarian crisis that you alluded to, but also this ongoing Yemeni support for Palestinians in the fight to stop the Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza?
Thank you for asking this question. You know, I've heard a whole bunch of people talk about this. All of a sudden, there are so many Yemen experts out there. It's kind of funny, but as you know, this has been a conflict that I've been working on, specifically trying to end U.S. military aid for the Saudi-led coalition's war and blockade on Yemen, which has pushed so many people in Yemen to the brink of famine. 80% of the population relies on food assistance for survival. We have people that have been internally displaced from the war in Yemen four or five times sometimes. And this is a war that's gone on for 9+ years. So this is really a tragic situation. And people are saying that the Houthis are using this moment, the Palestine conflict, for their own gain and really exploiting the situation. I'm assuming you've heard that too. But people have to understand, Yemenis really have a lot to lose. Saudi Arabia and the Houthis have come together with a critical peace, a calm for calm. And that's at risk right now if they don't, if they continue in this, the solidarity struggle with Palestine. So I think people need to understand just how much Yemen has to lose. And how painful the Saudi blockade still is, even though there is this calm for calm, and Saudi hasn't bombed Yemen in several years. There's a lot of reasons for that, which we could go into in large part because of the congressional pressure, because of their Vision 2030 and them wanting to move on from a really disastrous war that cost the Saudis billions and billions of dollars. It's still a fragile truce, and we have to see this, that there is actually a genuine belief in Palestinian liberation, and that's in part of what's going on here. certainly, you know, my organization, we don't condone attacks, you know, on civilian infrastructure, on, you know, in the Red Sea. You know, that's not what we're saying. But I do think people need to understand the context that there is a legitimate belief in Palestinian freedom among the Yemeni people, and really has been for a long time. A dear friend of mine, Aisha Juman, you know, I my heart goes out to her, her loved ones in Yemen that have been struggling so much. But she says this is nothing from what Palestinians have suffered for decades. You know, Yemen has suffered for 9 years. Palestinians have suffered, you know, under a 75-year occupation. And I think a lot of Yemenis feel that way.
Can you, I just want to stay on Yemen for a moment. I know that you said that this, you know, Yemen is one of the few countries that is in fact, that has in fact really taken action to speak out and to do, try to do something to end the genocide that is happening against the Palestinians. And as you mentioned, they are doing this at great risk to their own situation and crisis. Can you just elaborate a little bit more about how, although there is this sort of very fragile truce in place with respect to Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Yemen, why is it that that's at risk with Yemen continuing to stand up against genocide the way they are?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, right now, the U.S. is doing direct attacks on Yemen. So there's a risk from that. There's a risk from direct Israeli attacks. But there's also going to be, I think, increased pressure on Saudi Arabia from the U.S. And Israel. You know, there's been a long, you know, held belief that there among a lot of people in D.C., the foreign policy establishment here that's perpetuated so much war, that we should have some Saudi-Israel normalization. And there is going to be a lot, there is a lot of pressure on the Saudis to escalate against Yemen. So far, they haven't done that because I think they feel, you know, vulnerable. But there's going to be increased pressure to increase hostilities and also just pressure on them to not let up on the Saudi blockade. They've restricted flights. They've restricted commercial imports and humanitarian trade and could even further restrict those items, which are creating massive amounts of humanitarian suffering. There are pockets of famine in Yemen right now, and that is getting worse tragically, you know, as this bloodshed continues. So there's a lot to lose. The Saudis have, you know, there's more that they could do to restrict humanitarian trade. And obviously, you know, increasing attacks on Yemeni territory is something that, you know, is not out of the question here. So a lot to lose. And that's why we need a ceasefire. We need regional de-escalation. We need the U.S. to do more to end its complicity in the war in Gaza and stop, for the love of God, doing these unauthorized strikes on Yemeni territory.
So my last question on Yemen, and then we'll move on to Lebanon and Iran. Where does the UN stand with respect to the Saudi blockade, as well as to Israel's strikes in Yemen, as well as the United States strikes on Yemen?
Yeah, the UN has kind of been at the heart of a lot of the ceasefire negotiations and the that's another conflict. The UN has been working on this for a long time. Hans Grundberg is one of the lead UN negotiators working on this conflict. Now, they have pushed for this deal, have been working really hard. And obviously, this war and its spiraling violence across the region that's now spreading into Yemen just complicates all of those efforts. I think there have been a lot of, a lot of these efforts that just have gone in vain. And the U.S., for its part, you know, I think it's really interesting that the Biden administration, even though they have said publicly that they don't think that these attacks on Yemen will deter future attacks, that this is still the strategy and policy that we're going to continue to bomb Yemen. So you know, it's critical that we just find a new way to approach this situation. It has to be diplomacy first. It has to stem from ending the war in Gaza, because these, you know, more strikes on Yemen is not going to solve this problem. And the Yemeni people, as people, you know, folks that have been following this for a long time know, is that 9 years of bombing and blockade did not deter them from, you know, still, you know, fighting against the Saudis and the UAE, pushing against Al-Qaeda Arabian Peninsula. This has not deterred the Houthis and the millions of Yemenis that are living under their governance. So why is it going to change now?
Yeah, and also, I mean, we're talking about 9 years of blockade and bombing of innocent civilians in Yemen. I wanna now move on to Beirut. This past Tuesday evening, as I mentioned in the intro, on July 30th, Israel carried out an air raid in Beirut, where 74 people were wounded and at least three people were killed, including two children. Can you tell us about this attack and the U.S. response to this attack by Israel?
Yes. And again, it just goes back to the same thing, that this regional escalation will continue to get worse and worse and worse unless there's a ceasefire in Gaza. Several governments, including the U.S., the U.K., and France, have now called on their citizens to leave Lebanon immediately, as tensions rise in the Middle East following not only the assassination of this Hezbollah military chief in Beirut, but also the assassination of Hamas's political chief, Ismail Haniyeh. So this is a very perilous situation. I mean, there have been tit-for-tat attacks on, you know, the southern border of Lebanon and Israel, and that's displaced tens of thousands of civilians. This has been just a horrible humanitarian crisis in and of itself. I mean, we pay a lot of attention to Gaza, but the civilian suffering happening in Lebanon, in northern Israel, is also immense. It's killed hundreds of people on both sides, and is getting worse by the day. We don't know where this is all going. There could be a massive response from Hezbollah, from Iran, from militias, Shia militias in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in the Houthis. So we really do not know where this is all going. But we do know that the U.S. has moved its military forces, several more warships. I believe there's a dozen or so in the eastern Mediterranean. Everyone's on high alert. They're asking U.S. citizens to leave Beirut, leave Lebanon as soon as possible. And that's a sign that they're preparing for a massive escalation of violence.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking about Israel's more than 17,000 attacks on five countries since October 7th, including the occupied Palestinian territory, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran, and Israel's dangerous escalation of violence in the region, with our guest, Hassan Al-Tayyib, an author, songwriter, and Friends Committee on National Legislation's Legislative Director for Middle East Policy and Advocacy Organizer. He also leads FCNL's work to end U.S. military involvement in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. He advocates for Palestinian human rights and also advocating to advance diplomacy with Iran. Hassan, you've already mentioned Israel's attack on Iran in Tehran. Can you talk a little bit more in detail about that? And if there's anything to add regarding the U.S.'s response to this attack?
Yeah. So Haniyeh, he was regarded really as the pragmatic figure within Hamas and the head of its political wing. He was leading ceasefire negotiations. And despite the Biden administration's public and private efforts to really press for the ceasefire, Israel's recent actions have, in effect, halted any serious negotiations for a hostage deal. Now, the Israelis have denied being part of this attack, but I think a lot of people, you know, based on past history and past behavior by the Israelis, they've typically denied these types of attacks. But a lot of people think that this was the Israelis. It's worth also noting that Secretary of State Blinken has said that the U.S. had no prior knowledge of this attack. And that's concerning in and of itself, because if Israel did go forward by killing, this high-level official in Hamas, that directly puts at risk U.S. forces across the region, U.S. civilians in the region, and really U.S. interests to pursue and finally finalize the ceasefire deal. So a very troubling sign. And this escalating violence in the Middle East, it's increasingly difficult to see how this ends. If you kill the lead ceasefire negotiator for the other side, that is a clear signal that you don't want a ceasefire deal and that you want to keep this going. And there are a lot of reasons for that, despite the fact that you've got Israelis in the streets saying we want a hostage deal, and the fact that Israel's military is saying that they are tired of this fight in Gaza. They feel like they cannot win a fight against Hezbollah without massive amounts of support from the United States. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his political fortunes are on the line. He knows that if he agrees to the ceasefire deal, that his Knesset coalition with in bed with folks like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, that his coalition will fall apart. He will lose power and potentially face legal consequences. So we're in a very difficult situation. It's not good for anybody. It just, again, really difficult to see how this goes away. The anticipated response from Iran and its proxies is uncertain. Will it resemble the April attacks, where Iran gave the United States 72 hours notice, allowing Israel, the U.S., and Arab Gulf states to intercept slow-moving drones with relative ease? Or will this be more intense and widespread, drawing fire from Lebanon, Yemen, Iran, Iraq, Syria, all simultaneously? We just don't know. I think it's worth mentioning that the U.S. is working behind the scenes to achieve regional de-escalation. I do believe that. But many have warned, including myself and a lot of people in the ceasefire coalition, have said that this is not going to end without a ceasefire in Gaza. It's just going to keep getting worse, worse, and worse. So our focus needs to be on securing the ceasefire. And the Biden administration, really, it's not enough to just say you want a ceasefire. If that's not happening, you need to start looking at other forms of leverage, like U.S. diplomatic support. These are, think about all the U.N. resolutions that we've vetoed since the start of this war. Think about the ICJ and the ICC rulings, arrest warrants for Bibi Netanyahu, saying that there is a brutal occupation going on, or saying that there's risk of possible genocide in Gaza. We need to be looking to enforce those rulings and back them up, and also making sure that we're not sending any more bombs that are sending this message of impunity to the Israeli government. And that, to me, is what we need to be focused on here in the U.S., to make sure that this doesn't get any worse, because we all know that it can get worse from here.
You know, you said that the United States is working behind the scenes on regional de-escalation. It's hard to trust that the United States is in any way, an honest mediator of any sort, because they're in no way neutral. In fact, they're very complicit in all of this. And I want to get to that, actually, with my next question. So, I think what a lot of people don't realize is that Israel's war on Gaza is not just limited to Gaza and Palestine, that as we've been talking about in this segment, that it's really affecting really the entire world. And as we've been talking about, as I've said in the intro, as you've been discussing, that since October 7th, Israel has conducted more than 17,000 attacks in five countries. As we've mentioned, the Palestinian territory, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran. And also, as was mentioned, the UN Secretary General even denounced Israel's most recent strikes on Beirut and Tehran as a dangerous escalation. Okay, all that said, Can you talk about how Israel and the United States are both engaged in a dangerous escalation that's not only creating regional insecurity, but creating global insecurity?
I think that's such an important question. So the government of Israel right now completely relies on the U.S. Military support. They completely rely on the United States to really bail them out of this horrific and worsening situation. Despite this, they think they can bomb their way to submission in Gaza and across the region, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iran. But everybody has to understand a fundamental reality that Lebanon, Hezbollah aren't going anywhere. Iran is not going anywhere. The Houthis in Yemen are not going anywhere. Shia militias in Iraq and Syria aren't going anywhere. The Israeli government's not going anywhere. Hamas and Fatah aren't going anywhere. So really, we have to figure out how to coexist. And that's been very difficult. A lot of people think that they can just, you know, wipe out, you know, the entire forces of these, you know, other countries, or just bomb their way into submission, but it's just not working. I think it's also important to understand that, you know, this really can get a lot worse, and there are even worse groups than Hamas to deal with. I think given the sentiment among a lot of young Palestinians that the older Hamas leadership might not adequately represent them, the prospect of Hamas actually being replaced by a group akin to ISIS or some other more media-savvy terrorist organization is a profoundly unsettling scenario that can't be overstated. You know, we need to learn from the post-9/11 world and our war on terror that this really is not a situation we want to mess around with. And if young people believe that they have no alternatives beyond armed resistance, an entity like this could grow rapidly and destabilize the region beyond Israel and Palestinian borders. This is something that the U.S. intelligence officials are starting to warn about. The FBI is starting to warn about. So it's directly in U.S. interest to get a ceasefire, to end this, get the hostage deal, pursue regional de-escalation, and find a way forward where people can live side by side in this region, not just Israel-Palestine, but really across the region, because this just gets worse from here. The U.S. is not just an innocent bystander, as you said earlier. We have given, since the start of this year, $18 billion of weapons and military aid to the Israeli government as they've used these 2,000-pound bombs to blow up entire neighborhoods, decimate generations of Palestinian families. And that hatred is just compounding and compounding. I could go on and on. I mean, there are also risks, you know, of U.S. reputation and standing in the world among the global South. You know, there's really a lot of risks right there that we could, you know, spend a whole another segment talking about the risks to, you know, just the U.S. economy, and really the list goes on and on. But we are complicit. We are selling massive amounts of weapons to the Israeli government as they commit war crimes and all these atrocities in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, and now they're doing these direct attacks in Beirut, in Tehran, and it's hard to see how we get out of this cycle of violence, you know, unless and until the United States really ends that blank check support. And, you know, that's why we're focusing our work on the Hill, on the ceasefire, on trying to end U.S. weapons to the Israeli government, and doing everything we can to get constituents around the country mobilized.
So that actually leads into our last question. We only have about 30 seconds left. What, if anything, can people here in the United States do to help put a stop to Israel and the United States campaign of genocide against the Palestinians and this ongoing escalation of violence globally?
Thank you again for having me on. One, people should go to fcnl.org/ceasefire. That will send a note right to your members of Congress. That's what needs to happen. We need to use that pressure to say, no more weapons. We need you to publicly call for a ceasefire and regional de-escalation. And don't forget about the important role of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, to provide critical humanitarian assistance in Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan. And keep listening to KPFK.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your work, Hassan, and thank you for joining us today. In the words of Martin Luther King Jr., injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been speaking today about Israel's more than 17,000 attacks on five countries since October 7th, including the